Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. Today I talk with Josh Ariza, a freelance designer and founder of Chomp, a lifestyle clothing brand based out of Costa Mesa, California. We talk about the value of mentors, running your own business, finding your unique voice, and more, all right after this. Skillshare is an online learning community for creators with more than 10,000 classes in design, photo, and more. Everyone can take a class, try a project, and even teach a class themselves. Premium membership begins at just $8 a month for unlimited access to learning. Plus, you can earn money by teaching on Skillshare, which means students have access to the most relevant, up-to-date creative skills. Students learn everything from design, to business, to photography, film, craft, culinary, music, writing, technology, and more from the world's best teachers. You can learn at your own pace and on the go with their free mobile apps on both Apple and Android devices. For busy people like you and me, Skillshare classes are designed to be bite-sized with short video lessons to fit your schedule. For example, I just wrapped up Draplin's lesson on making a family crest and have a lesson from DKNG queued up and ready to go. You can learn at your own pace and on the go with their free mobile apps on both Apple and Android devices. Plus, for a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code CreativeSouth. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. Are you ready to explore your creativity and meet a ton of new friends while you're doing it? Then head over to CreativeSouth.com right now and get your Creative South tickets. Join us April 6th through 9th in Columbus, Georgia for Creative South, where you come as friends and leave as family. If you like the podcast and want to help support us, head over to patreon.com/creativesouth. Every dollar helps us cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. Plus, when you become a Creative South patron, you'll get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, Creative South podcast stickers and t-shirts, and you could even get your own podcast episode. So please, help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. How are you?
Pretty good, man.
I still can't find what I did with my glasses. I took them off.
For, man. You just,
I took them.
You got questions for me?
Do what now?
Do you have questions for me? Is that why you need your graphic or glasses?
No, I'm just old and can't see. The minute the four goes in front of your age, your eyesight goes downhill quickly is what I'm finding out. So
are you in your 40s?
Yeah, I'm 41.
Oh dude, I didn't know that. I'm sorry. Dude, I'll pray for you, man. Babe, let's pray for Jason. He's in his 40s. I just got into my 30s and then I got injured on a motorcycle like 4 months ago, and
It wasn't a bicycle that did it.
No, cycling. No, I wasn't doing that. I was on a motorcycle, which my wife always wanted me to get rid of. So I didn't like. It didn't really help my case when I got injured, and then she got pregnant. So
yeah, that's another good excuse to.
I said it like she got pregnant, like I was not part of it.
If you weren't, that's a bigger discussion that I think the two of you need to have.
She's out here getting pregnant. I'm getting injured.
Yeah. So is this going to be your first?
Mm-hmm.
How much longer till she's due?
2 more months, I think. Yeah, we're about to... Yeah, we got about 2 months left. We just started getting like a nursery together and stuff. Mm. So I have to clean my act up a little bit.
I'm still working on it. Mine are 7.
How many do you have?
I have twin 7-year-old boys.
Okay, that's crazy.
We wanted two kids, just not at once.
Yeah, for sure. You know what's even crazier? Just a little bit of a relatable note. We actually have been pregnant a couple times before. We didn't make it all the way to term with some other ones. Mm-hmm. And Lauren was pregnant with twins actually one time. And she made it to like about half through the way through the pregnancy. They were the mono. So in the same sack, just super rare. Just
Yeah.
There's always going to be a challenge, but we didn't make it the whole distance. But
mine were born at 28 weeks.
So. Yeah, so that makes sense because they're always born early, isn't that kind of the thing? I mean,
not that early though. I mean, 28 weeks is so normal pregnancy is about 40 weeks. So uh-huh. 28 weeks is still 3 months early.
Jeez. Yeah. So you had to spend a long time in the hospital there.
Yeah. Andy was in the NICU for 8 weeks, and Will was in the NICU for 10 weeks.
So, oh, crazy. Yeah.
When they were born, Will is the smaller of the two. He was 2 pounds, 3 ounces. And then Andy was 2 pounds, 13 ounces, I think.
Oh, man. Jeez, those are tiny little babies.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And like at that point, like all the hair that covers their body still hasn't like come off. So they're like little Coke can sized monkeys. That was the best way I could describe it.
So they were saying that if Lauren would have gone all the way to term or she would have gotten to about 22 weeks, she would have had to be in there for them, I think. So in the hospital rather. So it was like never going to be like an easy thing. So, I mean, that was just like a first time that we had like a real early term miscarriage. Mm-hmm. Then we had we've had such bad luck. So
she's on the high risk regimen already.
Well, you know what's weird is like every one of those things happened for a different reason. So mm-hmm. it was sort of just she's not high risk. Like she's not even she's just normal. Just had bad luck. Like so. Yeah, I mean, pregnancy is no joke now. Like I always just thought like I don't know. I guess. It's probably better that like when you're a kid, your parents are like, well, if you have sex, you're going to get her pregnant. Like they just try to like warn you that like all sex ends in pregnancy.
And yet it like, still doesn't discourage us.
Yeah. It doesn't stop anybody. So, but then I realized now that I'm an adult, like just, like it's pretty common for someone to have sort of a miscarriage or just not even be able to get pregnant at all.
Yeah.
And it's nothing like it's sort of what I thought when I was a kid. I was dead wrong.
Yeah,
I
don't know. I think the older you get and, you know, the more you see friends having kids and things like that at an appropriate age, not at, you know, 15.
Yeah,
you become a lot more aware of stuff.
Yeah, the teen mom stuff. Definitely. I think that was like I think that was birth control enough for like a lot of kids watching MTV. They were like, nope, it's not going to be me.
Yeah. Thankfully, I was a little bit past that when that stuff started coming on TV. There was still music on MTV when I stopped watching it. Barely.
Well, you know, there was enough like, I grew up in the church and there was enough like, just like bad advice given out by like pastors and stuff that just like sex, the idea of it was just so terrifying sometimes. Like I actually heard a pastor during a like a youth group give a where he's like did you know that AIDS can fit through the smallest pore of a condom? He said that like from the pulpit, and like I was like, oh my goodness, do I have it now? Like, I hadn't even had sex at that age, but it was just like...
I mean, maybe if it's like a lambskin condom, but... another point where religion and science aren't quite meeting up.
No, he's just like, just get up there, scare the crap out of them, get down. That's my job.
I went to church, but like most Protestants on holidays and...
Weddings
and
are you from the South? I just assume
I'm not you're from the South. I am not from the South originally. I mean I've lived in the South now for close to 30 years, but I grew up in Minnesota.
Okay,
we lived in Minnesota until right before high school.
Stuff like this?
No, I say soda now. And especially where we are in the South, everything is Coke. It's just what flavor of Coke do you want?
Oh yeah, I'll have a Sprite Coke.
Yep. I still, you know, after I've been in Mobile, I live in Mobile, Alabama now. So
Proper South.
Like, that is proper South. Yeah. We are right on the Gulf of Mexico, right in the heart of the Bible Belt.
Oh, sure. You see a lot of Trump stickers around where you're at.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I saw I hadn't seen one. Like, I don't know if it's taboo to talk about politics in here. We don't have to talk about that too much. But I hadn't seen one because I live in a pretty moderate city, I think. Like, I don't – none of my friends are like way into politics. They don't like, they wouldn't go to like a rally or anything like that. But I saw the first one I've ever seen. And it was on such a nice car. I can't even remember what it was. It was like a Rolls Royce or a Bentley or something. And I was just like,
a car that, let alone, you shouldn't be putting a sticker on.
Yeah, no bumper sticker belongs on this car. And yeah. I saw one. I haven't seen a Hillary sticker or any of that around here. I haven't seen a sticker for anybody really, but yeah, that was the first one I saw. It was like 2 weeks ago. So it must be interesting to live in a place where like the on the surface everyone is sort of voting for one person. I like think about that a lot now because the election's happening right now, and I definitely have been working to try to find like, do I actually know any Trump supporters? Not too many, like. They're kind of in hiding, but oh man.
No, you know, I did that thinking, so I don't have to pick a side, because I've seen Republican candidates that I didn't mind, and I've seen Democratic candidates.
I'm with you. Yeah, it is. It's a bummer to be an independent during this election cycle, because I'm also an independent. Mm-hmm. And I think that feels like a moral high ground in some ways. Like, it feels like ideologically it fits within like how a conversation I would want to have, which is, you know, I'm open to most ideas, you know, like I'm even open to the idea of like us having different president from time to time. But then I realized, like, especially during this election cycle, like I contributed nothing in the primaries. Like, I did nothing. Like, so in some ways, like,
I mean, I voted for Bernie in the primaries, but I knew that wasn't going to do anything. So.
Yeah. Well, we don't even – California is just so late that – and we – you know, like, they don't let independents vote in the Republican primary. So it's like, well, like, maybe I should register, like, some – you know, whatever party and just vote so that I cannot pretend like I have some moral high ground. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. the ideology is, like, biting me in the butt of, like, trying to – pretend like I'm open to all these ideas, and then in the end it's like we're, you know, you find yourself going, well, what if I don't want to vote now? So like, vote at all? Like, do I not vote at all?
I mean, to be honest, I don't want to vote for either of them, but you know, I'm picking the one that scares me the least.
I guess that's sort of the lesser of two evils sort of example is really just the most perfect example here.
Yeah.
It's been pretty cool, though, overwhelmingly cool, that I feel like the most people I talk to have had a pretty level head about like the political election cycle, just more of a head scratcher of like, what is happening right now? Like,
I think that's the big thing, is it's, you know, that movie Idiocracy. It's so scarily accurate this year that it's
if you think about politics in general, like it should, I try to go down like a checklist and go like, okay, the person I want to vote for represents this in foreign policy. They sort of represent this in sort of military defense. They represent this in fiscal policies. And it's just like a checklist, right? Okay, you go down through the checklist and like that person aligns with it. Mm-hmm. It almost feels like this election, we haven't even talked about policy like at all. Like, and
no,
and
there hasn't been any.
Yeah, it's just absolutely frustrating. It's just like, who do I personally want to hang out with more? Like, that's not how I should vote. Like,
well, if I'm picking that, I'm just staying home, because
yeah, seriously, I'm not going out on that double date. I'm just gonna stick at my house.
Yeah.
Well, dude, I love that we just jumped straight into the most hot button topic that we could ever talk about.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
Absolutely.
I realized, like, on podcasts, like, I listen to my own voice. It sounds like a 14-year-old adolescent boy trying to do an adult's voice, doesn't it? Now that I said that to you, you're like, yeah, it sounds just like that.
I mean, I can't say anything. It's not like I have the most masculine, deepest voice in the world.
No, it's good. Well, you haven't picked up this full Southern drawl.
No, I really have it only with words, like individual words where it comes out. But like, I mean, I've lived all over the place. I've, you know, originally from Chicago, lived there till I was five, and most of my cousins still live up there. So we go, so really until I was in college, we went back there every year for like Christmas and
it's a cool
Fourth
place.
Of July and stuff like that. And then I grew up in Minnesota. So, you know, I got a little bit of that. Oh yeah, you betcha, that accent going on there. And then we moved to Orlando, which is like nothing.
You know, I grew up in Orlando.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So,
I mean, I know, I still feel like I have a lot of roots there. I mean, I haven't lived there for almost 10 years now. So, but I definitely know a lot of people there. I like Orlando a lot. I don't know if I would move back. We definitely have talked about it. If I could live on a lake, I might move back or something like that. But
yeah,
what's changed? You know,
what part of Orlando were you living in?
It doesn't really look nice. Dr. Phillips area, Sand Lake area. Right.
Yeah, I was in Altamont Springs.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I don't really think I don't have like a bias about Florida or anything like that. People, when you talk about Florida, they're like, you know, so many weird stories come out of Florida. I don't know if you follow the Florida Man on Twitter, but that guy's hilarious.
It's my favorite, one of my favorite Twitter accounts.
But wifey and I would talk about it every now and then. But it's like I would move back if I could definitely live near or on a lake. I had a lot of fond memories growing up there, but most of everything has just changed. It just looks very different from when I lived there. Did you go to high school there or
no? College? I literally lived there for 9 months, so I went to eighth grade there.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
so we moved right before I started eighth grade from Minnesota to Orlando, and then about 6 weeks before the end of my eighth grade year, we moved to Central Kentucky and lived there through most of high school.
What's Kentucky like? I don't even know.
I was the new kid for 3.5 years, if that gives you any indication. So, you know, your formative teenage years is where you want to be considered the outsider the most.
Yeah, for sure.
It also didn't help that I was also on the swim team. So you got a kid who's shaving his legs twice a year. You know, that really gets you not picked on, and had so many dates, was just so popular. Yeah.
Our lady killer.
Oh yeah.
I was on the swim team. I was very young, but I was not much of a swimmer.
Gotcha.
I loved Orlando, man. There's a lot of cool things happening there. There's a lot of really talented designers there. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of good, there's a couple of really great photographers there. There's a studio called Maven where my friends work, and mm-hmm. then that's a cool
I've
spot.
Heard of them.
I definitely look at that place as a potential market for emerging design and stuff like that. So, part of that too is like the internet has made it so that there aren't really like so many hotspots anymore where, you know, New York and LA were like the, you know, the major cities for agencies and design studios. And those were the only places that you could really be to if you wanted to like, you know, totally advance your career. But I think like, you know, now because of, it's almost like, the internet has made it so one, you can have an agency or studio pretty much anywhere, and two, that the type of work that you're doing can really compete with those other guys, those other marketplaces.
Yeah,
too, so.
That's the nice part is you don't have to be. I mean, granted, you know, the major metropolitan areas are always going to have the major jobs because there's more people living there, and that's just the kind of way things work. But it's really nice that you don't have to necessarily be in one of those areas to have a strong career.
Yeah. My whole career has pretty much been in the surf industry and apparel and stuff like that.
How'd you get into that?
I was really competitive in design when I was in college. I say competitive because I was entering award, you know, competitions and, you know, and doing portfolio review competitions and stuff like that. And I was doing really well, like, in that. And I was very ambitious. I don't know why, like, competitive graphic design is like sounds like underwater basket weaving. It's so, like, silly.
I just pictured two guys with, MacBook Pros in one hand and styluses in the other trying to deal each other.
Just sweating.
Yeah.
Like, fully drinking Gatorade. Like, I'm going to get through this. No, I so we had to have like the AIGA North Florida portfolio review was like a competition that we all kind of had to enter in. A bunch of schools are in it, and I won it. And later when we had graduated, my one of my professor friends of mine was like, "Yo, this dude called me from Billabong. He's a creative director. He was like, I need a designer, and I want to know if you had anybody to recommend. And I recommended you for it." And he's like, "Would you like to be doing that?" And I was like, "That sounds awesome." And then they offered me a job, and it was just totally luck, you know, just like a phone call into a administrator. Like, that, does that shit even happen? Like, yeah. And so I got a gig there, and they paid for my relocation package.
That's nice.
And like,
that doesn't happen much anymore.
I was making 45 grand a year, which to me was just like so much money. And I it was kind of an unreal deal, and I was ready to leave Florida. Like, I had just, it wasn't that I didn't like Florida. I just like had spent my whole life there. So I wanted to like try to live somewhere else. And the surf industry was something I always thought was really cool and sexy. And, it was really hitting its like apex at like, 2007 kind of area. So like designing t-shirts, you know, I wore the t-shirts, so, you know, why not design them? So, yeah.
So was that your primary role there? It was designing graphics for t-shirts and
designing graphics apparel. For tees, and apparel and, board shorts. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it turns out that was actually I was really a print designer. I wasn't necessarily like an apparel designer. But you know, they schooled me in kind of like how to do all this stuff. And it turns out that was a much more influential, fun role at that job than it would be if I had actually got into like the, you know, ad web team, you know, because at Billabong, a lot of times it's just the product sort of leads and then the advertising kind of follows, you know. Actually at Nike, it was sort of the opposite in a lot of ways. Like the marketing team would come up with a lot of sort of like the vision stuff, and then apparel and product would follow, which is totally weird to me. Part of that has to do with like seasonal calendar stuff, and then part of that has to do with sort of like political reasons why certain people get to make certain decisions at
God,
places.
I love office politics.
Dude, office politics are like career killers. It's probably one of the main reasons why Nike just wasn't like interesting to me staying at it when I moved over to that company, because, you know, for one, it just takes the lead times at Nike are just like really long. Like if you come up with a concept, it doesn't like get made for, you know, like a year and a half. Like, you don't see, like if I design.
So you're designing 18 months out.
Yeah. At Nike. Yeah. Like other companies, it's like your lead times would be like 2 seasons out. So like 6 months, you'd see your stuff like in the, yeah, it totally makes sense. But I think development calendar for shoes just takes a lot longer. Mm-hmm. So the reason why Nike is so successful though, in its ability to put product out there, is that it's a marketing machine. Like it's just a marketing master. Yeah. So they just decide like whatever thing we're going to stand for this season, that's the thing we're going to elevate to all of our advertising, all of our signage, all of our athletes. They're all going to be wearing it. It's this one color. It's this one shoe silhouette. And they just have they have literally $1 billion marketing budget. They just push it out. And so,
well, I mean, look at it. I mean, 30 years ago, Nike was on the verge of bankruptcy and they fought hard to get Jordan. And that basically brought them back from the brink of death. And then they started focusing all around stuff like that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, sports marketing so I actually have a lot of theories about like apparel companies sort of having like a very short life expectancy. Like, I think like an apparel company doesn't really stay relevant or important longer than 10 years. But if there's like a technology or equipment component to it, it can last a lot longer.
Oh yeah.
So I think like stuff like Nike, Adidas, Under Armour, they'll all, as apparel companies, can last a lot longer than, you know, a lifestyle brand, because they're introducing technology to it and people need that for equipment's sake. They need that for training. They need that for exercise.
Yeah.
But, you know, other, and they still have hot
need in air quotes.
Exactly. Totally. Need. Yeah. I mean, when you work out, you wear running shoes, you know, you know, when you play soccer, you wear cleats, you know? So, it's actually made me, sort of, I've become hyper interested in how trends work and what brands are like and why they develop big followings. And so I've become sort of a expert on, or, you know, an expert around apparel product branding and messaging in that way. So I got to kind of had some insights in sort of like how some of these big brands work mm-hmm. and got to see how they get, how the sausage gets made. Sometimes the sausage gets made and it's really gross. And sometimes the sausage gets made and it's really precise, you know, yeah. And it's really interesting. So, yeah. I mean, what's your background like? What's your,
I'm primarily print. So, you know, I'm creative director at an engineering firm, which sounds really impressive until you realize that, you know, I have such a small team for a fairly sizable company. I'm doing 90% of the design work myself. Uh-huh. And then, you know, I've got a couple part-time people who can do little bits of stuff.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the stuff that I can't take on, I'm subbing out to agencies and stuff. But I've bounced all around. I've gone from, you know, working in agency settings, to, you know, my start right out of college was I did pre-press for a printing company, which is actually where I met my wife. She was doing pre-press there too.
You were just like, man, let me see those strike-offs. Also, what's up, girl? <You're>
like, you know, it took me quitting and moving away for a year to realize that I wanted to date her. So
I haven't checked pre-pest in a while. So just wanted to know, what are you up to? Yeah. That's awesome. That's a cool story.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I did that and then I worked for, I left there and went to work for a company that any rest area you stop at is like the travel brochures and maps and all that stuff. And then I, you know, bounced around to a couple different agencies and started working in-house. So I've kind of done a little bit of everything. And through that, you know, I don't do as much design as I used to. I'm more doing marketing and brand strategy. So I'm figuring out where that positioning's going. And then kind of like you said with Nike, I'm figuring out what that positioning is going to be. And then building those branding and advertising packages around that.
Mm-hmm.
So
cool. You dig it though?
Depends on the day, but yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Well, because if they listen to this podcast.
Exactly.
You're trouble. No. Yeah. I mean, like, it's interesting, the trajectory of like design careers, sure. You know? So like I feel like when I was young, that every graphic designer had really similar ambition, and it would be like, eventually I want to own an agency, do cool design. I'm going to be the leader of that agency. And, you know, I'll be owner, you know, or CCO or whatever. And then when I got into design, I realized that like, creative services business model is a really weird, unpredictable business model.
It would be tough to get me to go back to working in an agency setting, that sort of thing now. So yeah, totally. You're right.
I mean, I think like, I mean, even on like a studio or even just the idea that year after year, you'll make more money, you'll get on better projects, you know, life will get better. Like, it's just like a full-on myth. Like, there's just that doesn't exist.
No.
Like, so I think there are probably like people like Michael Bayrut who like get to work on whatever branding project they want, like, or whatever. But I, from my perspective, like being a freelancer, I don't want to take on staff, like, and also I don't want like my overhead to go up so much that I can't take the projects on that I want, and I'm sort of forced to take on projects that I don't want. Like, let me give you an example.
Sure.
Like, I lost a bid on a packaging project for like a really cool chip company that's made and manufactured in Southern California, and it's totally organic. It's made with like five ingredients, and it's one of the most delicious chips ever I've ever tasted. I'm honestly,
I don't know. Have you had the new Lay's smoked Gouda and chive chips? Dude, those things are like crack.
I bet they are, dude. Because they're probably made by a scientist.
I'm sure.
Who just knows exactly what.
I'm sure there is nothing Gouda in there.
I love Gouda, smoked Gouda. Like, yeah. My wife like always buy it for me. So I tasted this chip. I love the product. I was so back in it. And this guy was just asking me to do weird like little promo POP pieces for him. And to be honest with you, I didn't really want those pieces, but I knew that he was going to have a rebrand soon and knew that I wanted to do it.
Sure.
So eventually he's like, hey man, I would love to, you know, get a proposal from you. You want to do like a, you know, a package design rebrand kind of thing for me. What would that cost? Send him back a proposal. I'm even kind of conservative on my proposal. I'm like, it probably, the package design is probably, you know, it was under 20 grand. It wasn't very much money.
Sure.
And, I mean, it wasn't very much money considering the amount of work that it was. And so
I love that we say 20 grand wasn't very much money.
20 grand is a lot of money to me.
Yeah.
But
20
I mean,
bucks is a lot of money to me.
Can I borrow money? So
if I can find some, sure.
He fully goes to his like board of directors and like asks them like, well, what do you think? Like, I can either use this agency, you know, that specializes in, you know, package design and food product and, you know, whatever. And, or I can use this kid, you know, I'm 28. I can use this guy, and he'll do it for this amount, which is, you know, less than half of what the agency was, you know, pitching to him. And the board tells him that he should use this agency. So I realized like during that time, so he got his package design, and I didn't really like it very much, and he didn't really like it very much. And I realized, at that point, so like 20 grand or, you know, whatever I was thinking was what he was going to have to do, 15 grand or something, whatever he was going to pay me, was a lot of money to me. But for that company, whatever they were charging him, probably like 40 grand or something, is almost no money to that agency.
Sure.
So they get this money, they have a junior designer design it, they pitch it back to them. And really the account guy is probably the highest paid person on staff for that account. And he's pitching it to them and they have a good deck, and they probably have some real data and insights of how packaging design, there really might be some science behind it, but the type of, you know, customer service or insights that he would have got from me for, let's say he even paid me the amount that was on my proposal, like he was going to get a legit senior designer level, insight. And I was going to approach this differently than them, you know? Mm-hmm. And what I realized from that situation was like money means different things to different people. Certain different amounts of money mean different things to different agencies and freelancers. And what I realized is like when I take on staff, right? Like if I get people underneath me or I have people working for me, I'm going to be forced to take on projects just to pay those people.
Sure.
And I won't be able to really give them the same type of effort that I really and care that they would probably need for their brand.
Yeah, you don't get to be hands-on at that point because you're trying to find
new work.
Yeah, new work, and you're trying to manage everybody else what they're working on and stuff like that. So you don't get the personal touch that you do now.
Totally. And this guy to me was like a fine, not because of how much money he was going to give me, but because I really liked his product. But that agency doesn't really care. They don't look at him as a gold star, but I do look at him a gold star.
Sure.
But at the same time, like let's say Nike, when I was you know, working there and hiring designers for, you know, line planning for, you know, whatever category I was working on at that time, like I would have $1,500 per graphic, right? $1,500 would get me a great freelancer for a couple of days. Like mm-hmm. I use them top to bottom for a couple of days. $1,500 to an agency is like nothing. You can't even like use them at that point. So let's say when my personal rate goes up so high that, you know, there's a minimum 10 grand to even start working with me. Those 10 grand projects, like 10 grand or more projects, are harder to find. And it's not like Nike is actually giving out the 10 grand projects. They're giving out the $1,500 projects to 10 grand. And then they're not giving out anything up from 10 grand to a quarter million. They're not giving it to anyone.
Right.
And your operating costs at a mid-level agency are going to be in that like 10 grand to quarter million dollar.
Sure.
Like billing. And so it's a tricky thing, creative services. Effectively, what I'm saying is like, you either want to be the big guy, White and Kennedy, or you want to be the small guy who is me. And you just kind of operate more like a hitman. You know, I mean, that's my theory. I don't know if that's really true, but it's
sort of I do freelance on the side, and I've definitely noticed stuff like that too. Is, you know, I'm more effective, and it's easier for me to get the jobs on the things that are smaller price points than it is on the things where I'm going to be fully embedded, and you know, it's going to cost a lot more money. Now, I mean, that being said, a lot of times those bigger jobs are the jobs I want, and it's not because of the money. I mean, don't get me wrong. I would kill for that money, especially if you see my, you know, 9 or 2000 minivan that's out there falling apart in the driveway. But generally those projects are a little more fulfilling because you get to see all these pieces and components come together. So it's, you know, like a chess game or like you're putting together a puzzle. So that's the fun part of it.
Sure. I agree with you. Also, kind of like part of my ideology is that I just don't really take on projects that are going to last longer than like 3 weeks. Like part of that is just like, is I get bored, you know, so I don't really like things that take a long time. I mean, I'll take on a project that takes about max, so like top out at like 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it has to be a nice project, like, has to be a project for sure I can show. Like,
sure.
And like, because when you spend all that time on a project and then you can't show it, like, that's really just like, I'm trying to build a portfolio that gets me all the best work all the time. So when I take on a project that I can't show to anyone, it lasts for a month, I miss out on some opportunities there. So,
I very rarely take on a project that I can't show. And I've had clients that have asked me, you know, we want to keep this under an NDA. I was like, you can keep it under an NDA until it's public. But at that point, if it's out there, no, I worked on this. I'm going to show it.
Yeah. But I mean, even like you might not want to show.
Oh, yeah. Well,
I asked you like,
no, local, unfortunately, I've had some local, that have turned into that.
The local YMCA wants you to do a line of pamphlets for their dodgeball tournaments. Maybe, I'm sure you can make that cool, but like my point is really like,
I get where you're going with that.
I'm possibly trying to write my ticket to the next good project.
Yeah.
You know, so like I definitely know designers who make way more money than me. And I also know designers who are much more strategic in like the types of brands that they get to work for. And so the ones that I'm actually trying to learn from both, but I think the guys who are strategic about who they work with, those are the ones I'm really interested in. Mm-hmm. So like the way that they navigate those roads to get to work with their dream clients is very, very interesting to me. And then eventually how their dream. Well, who's a dream client of yours? I'm actually curious.
Oh, I don't know that I have a specific, but as far as like a type, I would love to do some branding design for like a beverage company, specifically like beer companies. And I don't want the big ones. I want like the small starting up.
The craft guy.
Yeah. I mean, and that doesn't come from because I think craft beer has the coolest design. It comes from, you know, when I was in college, I was waiting tables and I worked at a small, you couldn't even call it. It was a microbrew pub. Like they made 4 beers because of Alabama. They couldn't sell them outside of their doors. And up until that point, I didn't even like beer. Like, I thought beer was gross. I equated it with my dad's old Milwaukee that I, you know, snuck out of the garage in the middle of summer when I was like 10 years old and shotgunned and then puked immediately afterwards. Like, it hadn't even hit my stomach and I was spewing. So that's what I was equating beer with. And I started working at this brewery and I was like, I really like this. And that's how I got into like home brewing. And stuff that. So now it's like, I would love to do that.
You brew beer right now?
I haven't done it in about a year and a half just because of time and stuff like that.
Sure.
My, you know, you can see my office / laundry room / fridge over there. I don't have a space to keep the stuff that's fermenting at the moment. I gotta declutter some stuff and find some space for that. But yeah, I mean, I love brewing beer and it's fun. It's just a fun. Like, nobody gives a shit about a project, so you can make it as cool as you want to. And the guys that you get to work with because I've done a couple for, like, friends. Like, I haven't done the full branding, but I've done a couple, like, packaging mock-ups for them and stuff. And those were just fun.
Yeah. Well, the smaller guys, sometimes, like, you're given sort of some advantages and more risk opportunities to kind of, like, you try some kind of new things. Sometimes you can sort of lead the conversation with those clients and like, let's do something a little bit risky. Let's do, you know, there's this guy, Josh Emmerich. Have you interviewed him?
No, but I would love to.
That guy is super talented. I look at his stuff and he makes me feel like a bozo in graphic design. And I look at his stuff and he's always doing stuff for brewery companies. I think he even did a class recently for how to do branding for that. So he probably knows exactly how to get into that. So like I try to focus all my effort in business towards the exact type of clients that I want, you know. I think like a lot of freelancers tend not to make their objective that their dream clients, you know. They sort of like, I'll have a great portfolio, I'll tell my friends about myself, but the idea of like them putting themselves squarely in front of the people that they want to work with is like foreign to them. It's just like, it's like, well, that's really what an account guy would do at an agency, so that's not really for me. Or I sort of just like, if I just do the best work, the best companies will come and ask me for work. And I just like,
it doesn't work that way. You gotta go out and ask for it.
Yeah,
because I mean, a lot of times, I mean, I don't know if this has been your experience, but with my experiences, a lot of times they don't know that they want to do something. Like, I mean, they have an idea of, hey, we need to do something, but they don't know what they want to do or where to look for that. And they're doing what everybody else does and Googling graphic design, beer bottle label.
It depends. Like it's like, okay, so if I'm at, back when I was at Nike, like I was hiring freelancers, you know, to work on stuff that I worked. So I knew all the right places to look, but then there was other times where like, I just wish that like I had, Nike has a vendor list, but like this idea that like, when you put yourself in front of somebody, you're like doing them a favor.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, great. Now I have a good resource that I can use for this thing. Certainly, you know, given or granted that you actually know how to design, they're going to be stoked that you did that for them. You know, it's not an imposition at all to send somebody an email like, hey, I want to work for you. That's kind of the thing that I'm always like preaching to you. You know, I'm mentoring a guy called, Garner, and he's super talented, animator, and he's like, I think he just took a full-time job at an agency or another friend's agency, but he, you know, I was like challenging him, like, dude, I want you today to write 50 emails to every brand that you ever wanted to work for and just tell them that you want to do that, and I promise you next week you'll hear back from a bunch of them and you'll have some work. Like, it's because it's easy for, there might be even that moment they're like, oh shit, great, I had found a freelancer that I wanted, I was effectively going to be looking for.
Sure.
So, you know, that's a big thing. That's why I asked you what your dream client was, because I'm kind of curious, like,
I'm like the worst in the world at like putting myself out there to find clients. And part of that is I've got a full-time job that pays pretty decent and it's got good benefits. So why take the risk? When Now, granted, I'm also, you know, doing a podcast that takes up a bit of time. I mean, it doesn't take up as much time as people think, especially my mother.
How many are you doing a week? You're doing like one a week?
I record 2 a week and I put two. I'm going to start putting out 2 a week full time this month.
I actually didn't even know, like, what's your relationship to Creative South, the conference?
I am on staff, which sounds impressive, except for we're all volunteers. So, well,
yeah,
we're all unpaid, not making money. That includes Mike.
I hope you guys make a little bit of money.
I mean, a little bit of money, but it's not all the money that gets made from it goes into the next year's. So it's just, it's always rotating. That's, you know, kind of the goal of it is to keep it going and form community. So, yeah. So
people talk so highly of that conference, by the way. I know I'm trying to sidetrack this.
No. That's fine.
People have the nicest shit to say about that thing, man. They really, really like the conference and it always looks super cool. And the lineup of speakers is always good.
Yeah. We need to drag you out there.
Dude. Yeah. I meant to go last year. Actually, Noah invited me. And I think Mike even gave me a free ticket. he needed some like advice on illustration. And I just told him like, call me. Yeah, we'll Skype about it. And we talked and he's like, here's a free ticket. And I just didn't go. I'm such a kook. But back to you. Freelancing is not really like something you're super motivated to.
No, but the more I do the podcast though, the more motivated I am to do that because it, you know, for me, it was always, you know, the goal was you get a stable job, you get a 9-to-5 paycheck. It's got good benefits. You're safe. You're stable. Everything's great. The more I get into that, that stability thing is, I mean, yes, I work in-house. My company's not going anywhere, but you know, if they've for some reason changed their mind, like if they listen to this podcast, you know, I could be out of a job the next day. So that stability thing's a myth. I mean,
we learned that with our parents' generation. Like my dad lost his job after 20, 25 years or whatever, and just was, you know, didn't work for 10 years because there was no, I mean, the reliability of a company to keep you employed, it can be tough.
Yeah,
you know, I think though that like I think it's also maybe I don't want to oversell it, but I think it's also a myth that freelance is somehow sort of dangerous or that it's highly risky.
I think that's what it is. It's risky. It's scary. You've got to put yourself out there. I mean, that's always been the biggest thing for me. It's the biggest challenge. Where I was going with that is it's I'm terrified to put myself out there and ask a stranger for something that they could say no to. That's why I sucked at dating when I was younger.
Yeah, so for like dating is like fills your wants, like freelance.
Apparently you did a much better job at it than I did.
Well, no, I mean, okay, listen to this. I feel like I could build a practical guide for you, especially someone like you who understands the internet.
We are talking freelance, not dating, right? My wife will get very upset if she hears that.
I haven't dated anyone besides my wife in about 7 years, 8 years, so I wouldn't be able to write one about that. But I think the only thing, the knowledge I have about dating would be to like get a puppy. And if you just walk around with a puppy, girls will talk to you, I think is the thing.
Oh, is that what worked for you?
But for freelancing, freelancing, like, I think it's okay. One part is making great work. Okay.
Yeah.
So that if you can make pretty pictures on the computer, and even if they're not for real clients, like, if you can do that, I can teach you how to make a business out of freelance fairly quickly. I think. I believe that anyone who knows how to make pretty pictures on the computer can do it.
All right. Well, when we get done with this, I'm hitting you up for that.
Yeah. Well, like, look, it's really the putting yourself out there is easy because the rejection isn't like you're at a bar, you know, talking to a girl. It's really more like you sent an email and you didn't hear back.
Yeah.
Like, is that that bad? It's like really not that bad. And like, I would say when I first went freelance, I was terrified of it. You can ask my wife. Like, I was literally at night going like, well, if, what happens if we run out of money or whatever? And it's, you get as much as you put out there. So let's say sure. for every 100 cold emails you send out there, you'll get a response from about a third of them. You know, it'll be positive or negative. You won't even hear from the other two thirds of them. They just, they'll get your email. Maybe they'll file it and put you in their vendor list. Maybe they won't even care. They'll just go straight to their spam. And then the other third will respond. And then probably like 20% of those people will have work for you. They will just right away go, oh great, I was looking for someone, and they'll hire you. Like, and so it, people can't hire you if they don't know you exist. And if mm-hmm. you do decent work, then they will want to use you. It's just like when I need someone to clean my house, my wife and I actually have no idea who's going to clean my house. Like, we're just sitting here going like, well, we need someone. To clean
house. Rock, scissors, paper.
Like, yeah. No, I mean, like, we're going to hire someone to clean yeah. my house. Kid code. So it's like, we don't have a Rolodex of people who clean houses. Like, so if somebody, like, I just met someone on the street and they're like, yo, I clean houses. I clean the best houses. Look at this house. I clean this house. I would be like, you know what? I'm gonna let you clean my house. Like,
Mr. Trump.
It's just a convenience. Yeah. That sounded just like Donald Trump. I clean the best houses.
Bringing okay. it back to the beginning.
Yeah. Oh man. Are you going to watch the debate tonight? Do you think?
When we get all good? You know, probably not. Part of me wants to, but by the same account, I'd rather go watch Guardians of the Galaxy with my kids. That seems more fun. I already know who I'm going to vote for. Yeah, so yeah. this just seems like me spinning my wheels and wasting time and me, you know, turning to that old man who's yelling at my TV screen of, you know, those are lies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, definitely under, I fully respect that as an answer because you're a wise man. But like, when I feel like we're going to look back on this and it's going to be written about like in history, like,
oh, I'm going to DVR it so I can watch it. Don't get me wrong.
You're just not going to watch it live. Okay.
Yeah. Totally different. I'll be watching it at 2 in the morning going, why am I still awake watching this crap?
Yeah. What, like, I'm actually kind of curious. Because you live in Mobile, Alabama.
I do.
Is there a creative community there? Like, that you kick it with? Like, the people you hang out with?
It's not a great one. So we have an AIGA chapter here that we started. I was on the board for until a few months ago when my time was up pretty much. Uh-huh. And it had become kind of apparent that, you know, I should kind of step aside. But I won't get into that. Because sure. I really do believe in AIGA and that it serves a good purpose, especially in places like Mobile where you don't have this opportunity to meet a lot of other people in your field. So you've got to have something where you can centralize stuff. So it's getting better, but it's still not great as far as the creative community.
Totally.
But, you know, we're working on it. So
we didn't really have anything here, and we decided to start – we were just like doing like a show and tell, like in the morning, just with our friends. Mm-hmm. And we were like, oh, we know creative mornings exist, but we didn't like do a chapter here because we just thought it'd be too much work. And then we just started another one. We started like a totally different thing. That's exactly, it's exactly as much work as it would be to do creative mornings, probably more work. It was called Connecting Things. But it's been really cool because I realize like how important the creative communities are to, you know, just like your personal growth. Like, I can understand it's like there was times I was freelancing where I was just like, man, it's like it kind of feels like an island out here. Like, I'm just doing my own thing. I mean, there's people over at Dribbble or people on Twitch just where they were making cool stuff, but I didn't really like hang out with them or
learn
from them or glean from them.
Yeah, that's very much the same thing it is here. And that's, I mean, going back to, you know, a while back you asked me what I did with Cruise. That's how I got involved with it, is I had heard about it. Do you know who Diane Gibbs is with Design Recharge?
Yeah, I see her. I've watched one of her shows.
So she lives in Mobile. She lives about 15, maybe 20 minutes away from me. Not that far.
Uh-huh.
And a buddy of mine from college works with her. Like, they serve on some same board at the college. He's like economics professor though, or something. Mm-hmm. But he told me, hey, you should check this out. You're a graphic designer. So I started watching it. And then Mike was on there. Like one of the first episodes I saw, Mike Jones was on there talking about Creative South and how it was coming up in a few months. And my wife and I really wanted to go. We didn't have two nickels to rub together at the time because we just had to get like new tires on both cars. Everything was like, oh, we don't have any extra money for the next 6 months. And then we just Peter Del Tondo was giving away tickets through Design versus Cancer.
So Peter's out here, right?
Yeah, Peter's out there. Yeah, he's out in he's out in Irvine. So he was giving away tickets, and yeah, we just put in to win, and then four people not being able to go later, he picked us.
Rad.
And we went and fell in really quickly with everybody there.
Yeah.
It was this weird situation of I didn't know what I was missing until we got there.
Totally.
And it's like, I, you know, short of mortgaging my house, I will be there every year.
Oh, rad, so. Dude. Well, yeah, I love what you're doing. Why hasn't Mike asked me to talk yet? Why hasn't he reached out to me today?
I have no control over that, man. I'm still trying to get him to do stuff for me. So, take that up with Mike. He's much larger than I am, so I'm not about to ask him.
I could just reach out to him and ask him like specifically, but I did give him a long list of people I think would be super talented. I saw I'm going to totally out him on this podcast. I don't know when it comes out, but I saw him reach out to the Invisible Creature guys over Twitter. Like, hey, what's your guys' email handle? So I got my fingers crossed. I think that those guys are going to talk. They're super talented. Did you ever look at Asterix Studio back in the day? Do you remember Asterix? Asterix was like this super group of like four designers, two brothers who are Invisible Creature, and then another guy called Greg Lutzi, and then I think another guy was on, I can't remember, but Asterix Studio was a major influence on me, man. They were like, back when I was in college, some of the stuff that they were doing for album covers and all that stuff was just blowing my mind. And I remember even during like a show and tell, people were like showing their favorite work or their favorite designer, and Asterix Studio was like the studio that I was showing like in my show and tell, and those guys are just going on to just make such cool stuff. I really hope that they end up talking at Creative South, and then we'll be in the green room together talking about what we're both going to be talking about on stage, and it's like, what's up? No, I'm just kidding.
Everybody last year was really quiet in the green room, like the year before. Yeah. There's a bunch of shy people this year, last year, I guess. Not really, but I mean, I think part of the problem was there were like four people whose computers had crashed
the day before.
So everybody was in panic mode trying to put it together. I think like
one of my mentors talked last year.
Yeah, Noah. And I wasn't able to see his. I don't remember what I was doing. Oh, I know what I was doing. I was doing Type Fight in the middle of his. So I wasn't able to see him talk.
He's talented, man. He's like definitely that guy who like should be at a TED Talk. Like he could easily just do a TED Talk, and it would totally fit right within the realm of what they're doing.
I can see that.
He's having a conference out here called Reimagine Conference. I'll be talking at. So I don't. Okay. I think it's sort of like a creative entrepreneurship thing. So
yeah,
I've seen
him posting stuff about it because I follow him on Twitter and all that.
Dude, what's been your favorite talk like that you've ever seen at a conference that you're like, this thing just hit me and it was just like, wow.
Last year, Carlos Basabe.
Tell me about him. I don't know. Oh, that's the illustrator guy. Dude.
He's an illustrator. And he just talked about growing up and kind of feeling like an outsider all the time. And I just really connected with that because that was definitely me. And, you know. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people still connect with that. And then probably the second one would be Lenny Terenzi's talk the year before, which was a lot of this. He just talked about, you know, how he had gotten stuck in a rut and, you know, it took him, you know, his marriage falling apart, trying to get back into things, just trying to find himself.
I get it.
After all of that and pick up the pieces to figure out what he wanted to do and who he wanted to be. So I, he and I are the same age. So that hit home a
lot too.
He looks much older though, right, Lenny?
I don't even know who that guy is. Did you post? You posted somebody else's talk today over Twitter, didn't you? Who was it?
Oh, Ryan Aruda's episode was just on the podcast, and then I don't know. I've got all that Twitter stuff automated, so I can't remember what gets posted.
Really?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'll.
Yeah, we did a really good conference talk. Was this? I don't really know him, but
Von Glitschka does a good one.
Von Glitschka. That's who I was thinking of. Okay. That's what I thought you posted, but I think this other guy called Daniel Mall, mm-hmm. I think is his name.
Dan Mall. Yeah. So I went to the Montoose, the Epicurrents one that Dan Petty puts on last year in March, and Dan was at that. And I had the opportunity to talk with him up there a little bit. Yeah, and he was really
apprenticeships
nice.
That, I don't know. His apprenticeship thing is really, really cool. It definitely inspired me to think like, of really sort of like the giving back, but also sort of mentorship, but also sort of training, you know, young talent that, you know, doesn't have a lot of opportunities to go to school or is just really eager to learn. And yeah, it's got me thinking, I kind of need to talk to him a little bit.
Yeah.
Closely to figure out.
I laugh that we keep talking about mentorship because one of the things that you and I went over on Twitter for so long was, I'm trying to, without calling out the person in particular, the kind of snake oily stuff that is kind of going on with a lot of people out there.
I didn't really realize that there was an industry around like sort of the sales, the things that I thought were mentorship ideas, but they sort of get packaged and sold. So like, you know, I will talk to young designers and it'll be interesting, like designers who I really care about their portfolio, I care about their sort of personal growth, just like the types of people that they'll reference when we're having conversations.
Sure.
The types of things that either their teacher told them or some, you know, air quote, like famous designer told them, and just like what's real and what's practical, you know, like, for me, I look at my portfolio and kind of the things that I've done, and I feel like it's moving directly in the direction that I want it to. It's not fluff. It's based on, you know, I went and got these clients and I got to do cool projects with them, and I want those things to happen exactly for the young designers that I mentor, and especially the ones that I think are really talented, because I know that they definitely can do it. It's super low hanging fruit for them. Someone like Garner, who, you know, I was talking to the other day, this kid is going to definitely do really great stuff. And so when I hear designers, I heard a designer say he was following some other person's advice, and they were telling him, well, you know, eventually you need to work less so that you can focus more on family and friends. And eventually you just want everything sort of automated. And the idea was that you'd be more of a manager of these things. And I just thought, like, maybe people are just selling unrealistic expectations about like what your career path is going to be like. So like this idea of the 4-hour work week, I don't have to read that book to know that it's pretty much bullshit. But the idea that that's the thing that you should be working towards is sort of just nonsense.
Well, have you read that book, by the way?
I haven't read it. What do you think?
I would recommend you read it because it is not, despite the title, it's about how you can minimize the things in your life that take away from the things that you want to do.
No.
But it's a really good book. And I don't buy into the literal title of the 4-hour work week. And he doesn't either. Like, if you read Tim Ferriss's book, he like busts his ass every minute of the day doing stuff.
That makes more sense then.
Yeah.
So like not getting tied up in the logistics and stuff, you know, that definitely makes sense. But this idea overall that like we're going to be, that your life will be kind of like a half of a vacation all the time. It's like, it's sort of just like a very,
unrealistic goal.
Yeah, it's an unrealistic goal, but it's not something we should even really be working towards in general. Like we should really, as graphic designers, should make our priority to do the best work for all of our clients, but also get the best clients. Mm. And so And then however much you want to work is up to you, but it's a highly competitive industry. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of people who want to eat your food. They want to like take it off your plate. So like if you're not prepared for that and not planning for that, then you will find yourself as a designosaur. Like you'll find yourself someone who becomes obsolete.
I love that term.
So, you know, these guys who sell this idea, and it actually do mean sell, like people are paying them for the words that they speak to them, that that they know they have an ideology and you should buy into you want to get a lot of followers for the type of work that you want to do. You effectively want to become exact facsimiles of the type of business model that they have. And their business model is really selling business models. It's a strange time for design. So I was just saying that our industry is just primed full of like young designers.
Yeah, that's where we were.
We have a bunch of young designers who are very impressionable, and they listen to the things that all the you know, popular designers are saying, and the popular designers say a lot of things, and they're just hearing from them. And I just think that even me, like I'm just, I don't have that many Twitter followers. 1600 is not that many followers, but
about I have three times as many as I do.
Yeah, but it's just I want to be more careful about the things I say about them and error to them, but then that I also want to make sure that the advice that I'm giving them is very sound. And then also I'm not too sure of the advice that I give them. But I think like people speak with a lot of authority on the things that they've experienced.
Sure.
And they also speak with a lot of authority on the things that they haven't experienced yet. So, look, I think my career path is the type of career path that you should, that I could speak into some, you know, young designer's life and go, hey, maybe kind of try to do it like I did it. See if that works for you. Mm-hmm. But I also know that it's not the only way to have like a career in design. So
yeah. Well, I think that's been my issue.
It's so tricky.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry. No, I was going to say, I think that's been my issue with it is these people, a lot of these people, and don't get me wrong, there are people out there that sell online classes that are a form of mentorship that I actually think are beneficial, and I think they have a value in people paying for them.
I'll co-sign on some of those for sure.
And I'll give you a prime example because he's friends with them, and whether you agree with me or not, but Dustin Lee with Retro Supply. He's just started doing one that's called Passive Income for Designers. He doesn't guarantee that you're going to, you know, get rich quick and be able to retire on that. He's like, no, this is what worked for me there. But the nice thing about his class is he shows three different ways you can do it. And he's like, this is, you know, one way to do it. This is the step I started off with when I started doing it. Here's how I do it now. And they're vastly different. He's like, you know, this is a roadmap. This is what worked for me. But you do, you know, you can use these, but you need to find your own way. What's going to work for you too?
Yeah.
And he builds on
interesting.
That.
Well, giving advice in this day and age where the market is changing. And we also can't anticipate what trends are happening. It's really hard to give advice. So like I do sell consulting services and those services are sort of, they encompass, in a very short amount of time, you can ask me for my entire vendor list. You can find out about retail strategy. You can ask me about branding. You can ask for, you know, real-time examples of creative process from, you know, Nike, Stance, whatever company that I've worked for that you like. You can, I'll give you insights to how they come up with great ideas. Now, that service sounds very woo-woo, and but I am highly conscious that when I do consulting, that it's possible I could be wrong. So everything that I talk about that I think are the right choices that a company or brand should make, also footnoted as like, we can't know what other products are coming out around this time. We don't know what other brands are formulating ideas at this time. We don't know what other campaigns. It might be possible that you come up with the exact same idea as somebody else, and you push all your marketing dollars behind it, and it turns out it was a wash because someone else came up with the exact same idea. Mm-hmm. Or maybe even one season before you. Like, we can't anticipate
Look at Meerkat and Periscope. Those are in tech world, too. Exactly. They came out almost the exact same time.
You know. So I can sell those services, but it's also I can also sell them because I know that we work in a changing marketplace where we can't anticipate what things are going to happen. We can't forecast them. Mm-hmm. So it actually maybe Twitter is a rough place to give advice because it's only 140 characters. But when someone sells a service that is sort of business advice or whatever, it just I would like it if they maybe footnoted it as it's possible I'm wrong.
It's not the end all be all.
Exactly. Yeah. This is not the Bible.
So my red flag is if you're quoting yourself, I am automatically not going to do anything from you.
Yeah, I think I might have tweeted something similar to that.
You really?
Yeah, literally. Yeah, you can't quote yourself. Well, I think we have people that we look to, someone like Gary V, who like we would consider to be really, you know, savvy in investing, savvy in self-promotion and content creation. Mm-hmm. And then we sort of have all these facsimiles of like people who do those things, and they are sort of lesser, smaller versions of Gary V. And so but the difference between maybe someone like him and the people who are just like someone who is him and someone who's just like him, like you really want to go straight to the guy who's actually a practitioner and is still involved in those types of things instead of somebody sort of like left it and wants to give you advice on it. And a lot of like people who do
this
consulting,
is what I did to make $2 million. Exactly. And I decided that I was so good at teaching people how to do the other thing that I decided to leave everything I did that made me money to do this.
Yeah. And it's just, you have to take that all with a grain of salt. Yeah. You know, like, it's like those guys who are like, yeah, you got to buy gold. You need to buy gold. And you're just like, well, maybe that kind of worked for you, but like, maybe there's a different or better strategy right now to earn getting some return on my investment. And so,
do you ever watch the show Deadwood when it was on HBO?
I didn't watch it. No.
So do you know the basic premise is Wild West? It was Black Hills, South Carolina. There was a big gold rush there, and like Bill Hickok and a bunch of other people there. And there's this character there. And I can't remember his name. Ian McShane played him, but I'm blanking on his name. And all these people, all these miners and all come in there asking him why he's not out there panning for gold and why he's in this place selling shovels. He's like, well, everybody's got to buy a shovel for me to dig for gold. So why not just, avoid the competition, sell the shovel to you, and I don't have to worry about that. And I'm getting rich doing this.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like how many. So to your point, and like just the analogy, the best analogy of all that was like, if I'm looking for all these, hand lettering is really, really popular on Instagram. You know, it probably hit its apex even maybe 6 months ago or something.
Sure.
It hit, trying to be a competing for the same eyes that are really interested in hand lettering is like a really, really tough racket. So it's more advantageous in. The thing that I would want to preach most, if I could stand on a stage and talk to every designer, it would be to find a unique voice. Like, find a thing that is specific to you. Like, do something better than everyone else, and just make sure it's not the same thing that everyone else is doing. Mm-hmm. So it's like, maybe I'm wrong, but like competitive, like let's say you want to be an NBA champion. And like that would probably be way harder than it would be to get a gold medal in, let's say, archery, just by sheer number of people who are playing the sport, you know.
Sure.
So, you're, like finding a unique voice or even kind of working your way towards a goal, like if a lot of people are doing that same thing, it might be a great opportunity for you to zag, you know, like that's why Chomp, like my brand looks, you know, so different than other brands, is because I'm just really trying not to replicate the same thing, you know? And I think that's also where uniqueness comes as part of it. So
sure.
there's some portion of it, of the advice that I give to smaller brands or, you know, is that you really have to work hard to find what's special about you and make sure that it's not just like everyone else. And that's the thing that's really just going to sustain you over a long period of time.
Gotcha.
You know?
So since you mentioned it there, you know, with Chomp and since you're doing freelance work, what was it that made you want to start Chomp after, you know, leaving Nike and Billabong and all that? And to keep doing freelance work? Because, you know, a lot of people out there would focus on one or the other and not use both. What's your little philosophy on it?
So the reason I got offered, or the reason why I started Chomp, was because a friend of mine who's a buyer at a big box retailer basically said, hey, if you start a brand, like, I will buy from you. Mm-hmm. Like, I will buy t-shirts from you. And it was just like, oh, that was low hanging fruit. Like, okay, next week I'm a manufacturer. Like, why wouldn't I do that?
Yeah.
And at that time I also saw like a gap in the market where I just thought like humor was going to be really important to design. A lot of the things that I make tend to be funny. A lot of things that I'm interested in tend to be funny. And especially at that time, it was mostly like a bunch of brands that were like telling people to go camping and go explore more, you know, find your true self and, you know, like get outside. And like,
life is good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, they have like very comfortable shirts and I own several of them.
Yeah. I would say I would rather start a brand like Old Guys Rule, which is like a brand. So there's a, you know, I saw that and it was just like a very serious approach to, you know, apparel and a serious approach to branding. And I just like, I like it, but I was so tired of hearing it that I wanted to like do something that was whatever the opposite of that is.
Sure.
And so like at that time I had like been drawing like people were giving advice, like, you know, be nice and work hard and be nice, you know, those, that saying. And I was like, I would do like calligraphy or something like that. And I would say, so like, don't poop on an airplane. Like, and it would be like an exact same type.
You know, good advice, like, though. That is solid advice.
It's great advice. It's better. It's more practical advice.
Yes.
And so, I wanted to make something that was funny. And so my friend gave me this opportunity, and then the next week he had effectively written me a PO for 1,000 t-shirts. Like that's an opportunity that just came out of just knowing somebody. And so mm-hmm. But it wasn't like the brand didn't have a voice. It just didn't have a lot of, legacy behind it. So building a brand is really, really hard because you kind of have to hammer home the same narrative
sure.
for like a long period of time for people to kind of understand it, to kind of trust you, to kind of relate to it, to build an audience. And so I do that just for fun. It represents probably like 10% of my time.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want it to be weird. I want it to be interesting. And subsequently, it does seem like a lot of people have kind of shifted from that very serious narrative to a much more fun, lighthearted one, which I like. But I want to make cool stuff. And I like the inspiration for it was really Fresh Jive and sort of Stussy and these brands that are super cool, you know, iconic brands to me, but also were cult brands. You know, they weren't a brand that was on every dad around, you know, they were brands that were just, you know, funny and cool and irreverent. And
I had forgotten about Stussy until you said it.
Yeah. I have never, you know, but it's like those brands were important to me as a skateboarder and as like a surfer. And so, and then I just went in that direction. And then, it's really just a passion project, man. It doesn't make much money. It did like 50 grand in revenue the first year, and it'll probably do like 75 or 100 grand in revenue this year, but mm-hmm. it's not enough to like live on like at all. So it's really like 10% of my time. And honestly, like just the mentors that I have, you know, really are telling me that, you know, kind of revenue is really not that important right now. Really brand building is much more important. So I'm not really fit, you know, putting my whole focus on it. It's always going to be cool and original and funny. And how big it grows is really dependent on, strategic growth and not so much just trying to go big so fast. So I don't really like, you know, we're not going to buy followers for our Instagram account. We don't hashtag a ton of things just to get interest and likes. We, you know, that's just not a strategy that we have. We're more about partnerships and sponsoring young, talented athletes around here and those kinds of things, because that, those are the things that I find value in. And also I want Chomp to be like that thing that you just uncover when you're a kid and you just think it's so cool that like you share with your friends, mm-hmm. but it's not so big that it's, you know, I want the kids to follow it, to feel like there's ownership over it, because they do own it. And the kinds of kids who are part of the conversation, they're really funny, interesting, cool skate kids. And, yeah, I'm super proud of it, but as far as freelance goes, like that's how I eat. You know, I still want to work on the biggest, most fun project for the coolest brands, you know, so I target my business in that way. So,
you know, since you have this background of having, you know, with Chomp and having worked for Billabong and Nike and stuff like that, do you tend to, with your freelance stuff, are you focusing in that arena or are you going all over the page with stuff?
Yeah, it's really easy to find those kinds of projects, you know, to hit up, you know, some, you know, to get Under Armour projects, to get, you know, those guys are sort of low hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. But I really want to do all types of projects. I want to do branding projects. I want to do packaging design projects. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I probably, like you were talking about, like branding a beer company, like I'm not actually sure how you get that project. And it's really, you know, kind of piqued my interest there, because I was like, yeah, you kind of need to know a small brewer.
Yeah.
And you kind of get in there at the exact right time for whether they want to rebrand or repackage.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to figure out too.
I don't actually know that one, man. You know, but I think it is a rich get richer situation. So if you're looking at guys who do that kind of thing, they tend to get that type of work. So, you know, just in general with like whatever work you're showing, that's the type of work you're going to get. So, you know, for me, I get a ton of t-shirt work. I get a ton of, you know, board short print, ton of, you know, apparel stuff, you know, from similar apparel brands. So I don't have any complaints about that. I love the brands I work with. So I'm not, you know, some days I think I'm like, oh, maybe I need to put more iconography in my portfolio. So I need to spend some more time doing that. I did lose like a project to GoPro against another icon designer. And like I do icon design, but it's not like a primary like focus. You know, I did some stuff for Airbnb or whatever, but the losing that project to that designer made me like put a little fire under my butt and was like, oh, maybe I need to be working harder on this area of my portfolio so that I could get people like GoPro coming to me all the time. So I have
just hit up Charlie and, you know, beg him.
Yeah. He did work out of my office fairly recently. I was like, well, what's up, dude? Why did I lose the project? And he's like, I don't know, this guy's stuff is really good. And I was like, I'm going to send him an anthrax letter.
I'm gonna maybe find I should him. Cut that part out.
No.
if he suddenly dies from anthrax poisoning.
No. Oh, shit. That would be so inconvenient.
That would be very inconvenient.
What do you think about that? What do you think about Chomp? Like, do you think it's funny?
Oh, yeah. Like, I love it. It's going to sound weird. It's not my age range, so it's tough. Sure. But from an outside view of... I look at it when I was in, I always try to be objective when I look at stuff like that, when I know it's not something that's in my age range. And,
you know,
and I look at it and I'm like, try to be in that market sense. And I'm like, I would still wear this if I was still, you know, 19, 20, 25, up into even 25, I probably would have been wearing stuff like that.
Does it feel original? Like, that's like my main
thing. Yeah, it really does.
I'm always trying to make stuff feel original, but I don't know if it does.
No, it really does. It's one of those that it's, I don't know. It's not anything I've seen before. So that's, I think that's good. I think that can be scary too, though. So.
Yeah, it's definitely. Well, when you don't have to make money from it, you're given a lot of opportunities to take certain types of risks. You know,
sure.
Like, I think I want to keep taking those risks. So, you know, I'm not going to be loyal to whatever sells best. I think there's a real danger in that, like in the early genesis of your brands to want to just make the things that sell really well. If you don't have investor capital, I don't think you should really do that. You should make the thing that you really believe in or the thing that you're interested in, because that's what the market needs. So like, you know, Chomp was needed at that time. We've since been copied by some pretty interesting or large brands. So
I've noticed some of them.
We're actually suing a brand right now. So it'll be really, really interesting to see how that turns out. And so,
You never thought you'd be doing in your life.
Yeah, I'm happy to sue them though, man. They're a really big brand. I just like the small guy fight of, you know, what's that girl Tuesday who's been like all her stuff keeps getting ripped off by Zara and like some of these other brands. It's like when you're a small brand, I even remember looking at, you know, being part of Nike or being a part of any big brand where you go on long trips and you go and you try to uncover this very special, these small brands that are interesting. And, certainly at Nike or Billabong, we don't want to rip anything off. And these other seemed, I don't even, it might just be
you're
one
not old
person.
Navy.
Yeah. It might just be one person in the loop that's ripping somebody off. It doesn't have to be a whole team of anybody, but when you're a young or small, cool brand, like it's actually pretty flattering to get ripped off by somebody, because you realize that somebody's actually looking at your work. They think it's really cool. And then you actually are influencing the mass market. Like, you're where the trends start. And that's,
I think it'd be flattering until you got to go hire an attorney.
Yeah. Fortunately, my attorney is just like, yeah, man, we have a case. I'll just take a percentage of the settlement. So he's a cool dude. And,
well, that's good.
Yeah, I don't have to like pay him by the hour, which would be like $300 an hour.
I should have gone to law school.
Yeah, maybe. It's like,
that'd be horrible.
This guy, it sounds rough, dude. It sounds like a lot of reading. Sounds like a lot of like tough talk over the phone.
And really being really, really good with commas. So at my company, our legal counsel, she and I are really good friends, and that's, she and her husband actually own a brewery. So that's who I've done a little bit of stuff.
Oh,
for.
Cool.
But yeah, she's like, you know, most of what I do is hope to find that there's a comma in the wrong place so I can either get money from someone or get us out of having to pay money. So I know suck at that, cause I am horrible at abusing commas.
Well, something I want to ask you about then, like, so one thing I've been asking myself in general is like, sure, does creativity exist? Like, does it, like, are there new ideas, like brand new ideas? Like, because everything, so I'll draw something, let's say like a banana. I drew a shark coming out of a banana. Okay. Uh-huh. So that I had seen on Pinterest, like these moms were for like birthday parties or something, were like carving these bananas into like a little, what do you call those? Dolphins. Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's like actual dolphins coming out of bananas. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, I thought it was really funny. So I was like, let's do a shark. That's totally relevant. It's funny. I could call it slippery, whatever. So sometimes I'll draw something like that and think it's really funny and original. And then I'll just Google it, and I'll Google like banana shark.
And it's on
Pinterest.
And I'll
find somebody has actually drawn the exact same thing. Maybe not the exact same thing.
I think there are original ideas. I also think there's a lot of parallel thinking. And I think there's a lot more parallel thinking than people realize.
Yeah, maybe we're like a little too quick to call people copycats, but
Yeah, because I mean, I've made jokes with my friends, and then the next day I see them on like Fallon. There's no way those paths are crossing where like one of my friends went and talked to a writer over at The Tonight Show. Yeah. And it's like, no, it's parallel thought. They just happen to have pretty much the same idea as me. It's
especially topical stuff. Yeah. Like, I drew a pizza as a peace sign. Uh-huh. And then
I've seen that. I like that one.
Subsequently, I've seen a bunch of other Pizza Peace signs, and I just don't. There's no way that.
Well, yeah. So, like, I've seen you. I've seen you do that, and then right around the same time that you did that, I saw Scotty Russell, from Perspective Collective, do something really similar. But I mean, they came up within like a day of each other, and
yeah. There's no.
I
mean,
I know
way.
Scotty. I don't. He. There's no way he would do that. Like steal something. No.
So. Well, yeah. I wouldn't even. There's only twice that I've actually copied something. I think one. I was really young. And I was inspired by my friend Danny Jones, and I thought like what he was doing was really cool. So I made – I don't even think I really actually copied what he was doing, but as much as like I chose colors similar, and I think when I showed it to him, he was like, hey, man, that kind of looks like my stuff. And I was like, I should probably not be doing that. So
I will freely admit I steal color palette ideas from people all the time. And yeah, but it's in a – like,
really but copying. I'm
not – that's not copying. That's –
yeah, like, I don't know if it is. I don't think it is.
I mean, colors are colors. It's, and I mean, so much of that stuff is like dictated by Pantone 3 years down the line that you don't even realize it's getting into your brain. Yeah. So, well, you know, if you've taken a color theory class at any point in your life, you know what colors are going to work together. So it's just.
Yep. The other time that I think I copied something, I was looking at, I can't remember the guy's name right now. But I designed a T-shirt at Nike, and then I was just like, I even got the strike off, and it came, and I was just like, strike off meaning like the prototype of the shirt, and I was like, this looks too similar to design, and I killed the design. Like we didn't go to market with it. I just felt like it just looked too much like the inspiration. So the two times that I actually copied something, both times neither of them got made. So I like it was. Like I was really young the first time. The second time, I was just knew better. And yeah, so
I will say I have absolutely no shame in stealing color palettes. I don't think that's stealing. I think that's just, oh yeah, these are cool. But you know, so for me, I don't think I've ever since I've been out of college copied someone. But there was a time, especially like my senior year in college, when I was just so behind the gun and trying to get all of my stuff ready for portfolio and had a project that I saw a logo and I didn't like intentionally go out and copy it.
Yep.
But I made it. I got done with it. I was like, that looks really familiar. I turned it in for a grade. And then the next day I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
And I fessed up to it.
Yeah, sure.
I still got a really good grade for it, so I still don't know how I feel about that.
Well, I think part of that is like a time thing. Like,
yeah.
If you don't have you need to have time with projects. That's the number one reason why you can't rush, because you need to make original ideas. And like original ideas, just like they just there's not some magic.
They don't come out. They don't come out of nowhere, and they don't happen in a vacuum. I think that's the two things. And especially a lot of places expect that to happen. Is they expect, you know, you just to turn on a dime, switch gears, and automatically have another idea for something. And I think that's where that death of creativity comes from, is you're forced to not be able to put thought into things. So well, that's how that people end up stealing
creativity.
Stuff.
Do you think you can actually teach people how to be creative?
Yes.
Because this is a question I'm
actually
myself,
do. I mean, I think people have because creativity comes in all sorts of different ways, you know. So since we were talking about lawyers, I mean, think about it. If they're writing a lawsuit for someone and their argument before, you know, if it goes to court and their arguments are, they're going to have to write an argument that is compelling and creative in enough way to put a different spin on something to show that their clients have a valid case. So there's creativity in that factor. And then there's creativity in what we do, where it's, you know, we're drawing stuff for a living. And, you know, a lot of times we're making stuff up that doesn't exist in the real world and never has. And in the case of a banana shark, hopefully no one ever genetically creates that. though I will be watching that movie on Sci-Fi. What'd they have? Sharktopus? Sharknado?
Yeah. Well,
so
I just like,
I think you can teach people how to hone creativity. I think that initial creative spark has to come from somebody, though.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
I think everything is derivative. Yeah. I just like I watch designers kind of like get salty about other designers or they perceive them to be copying their work. And certainly I've even like falsely, you know, thought somebody was copying my work. And you know, it's just a, all of it's kind of a, every, we're all, the main issue is the internet. So we're all looking at very similar things all the time. So, you know,
well, if you don't when you share the same Pinterest board with 75 different people.
Where some guys, like, they pin something and they have 200,000 followers and everyone sees what they pinned. And it's like,
I am not that motivated on Pinterest. I don't know how people do that.
It works good for clients. Like, if you're like trying to show them something, you know, board,
I've done that.
So. I don't just nerd out on Pinterest. Sometimes I do see some cool stuff on there.
Ironically, if I'm nerding out on Pinterest, it is absolutely nothing related to design. I'm doing it like, you know, looking up recipes.
Crafts. You're big into crafts at home, like making a little.
You know, I got like we talked about earlier, I got twin 7 year olds, so it does come up from time to time.
Hey, man. Yep. You know? Well, dude, I mean, I'm glad we got to finally talk. I'm sorry that I dodged you so many times.
Hey, I had to flake out once, too. So
that's true. I'll give you credit there. What do you think, man? You think Mike's going to ask me to talk about Creative South? I can feel the good mojo right here. I think
I seriously hope so. I'm going to send this over to him. You can find out more about Josh on Twitter and Dribbble at Joshua_Ariza. And be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with them. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter and our new Facebook page at CreativeSOPod. And follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CreativeSouthGA or over at CreativeSouth.com. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code CreativeSouth. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. Don't forget to head over to CreativeSouthGA.com right now to pick up your tickets for Creative South in April of 2017. We're looking forward to seeing you there and hugging some necks. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at Patreon.com/CreativeSouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.